You are listening to Casterbus, the Doctor Who podcast with a K. I am Christian Corley, and with me this week are James Baldock.
Hello.
And Simon Daines.
Hello, listeners.
Oh, Simon.
Yes.
We only have one listener.
Oh, right.
I thought you knew that.
Yes.
Greetings, listener. I've got to be honest with you, chaps. I'm still slightly hungover, not in the alcoholic sense, but from the experience sense, from the WarpCon, it was 10 days ago now, and I still haven't quite got back into the swing of things.
Was it fun, Christian?
It was hard work. Lots of other people were having fun. I'm absolutely certain of that. I was particularly thrilled to see Dad Ross. He's amazing. How anyone can stay in character that long, I'm talking like 10 hours, amazes me. He's marvellous.
Just to be clear, for the benefit of the listeners at home and me, which Dad Ross was it?
Dad Ross.
Oh, Dad Ross.
Dad Ross.
Yeah, I thought that's what you said, and I thought, yeah. No, that must be my speaker.
No, it's definitely Dad Ross. He cosplays as Davros, basically, and he just zooms around grumpy with people. I'm convinced he's absolutely pissing himself laughing under the mask. He's got to be. I would be. But, yeah, he's amazing, yeah. And there was a kid, a young Doctor Who fan, say kid, I'm being a bit patronising, he's probably 13, 14. He had an Omega puppet that he appeared to have made. It was marvellous.
Did it have a head?
It had the full mask and everything.
Oh, the mask.
Like a hand puppet. It was, it was Three Doctor style Omega, not that 1980s thing. Yes, it was very good. Yeah, so lots of people had lots of fun. I should mention for the listener that we have some exclusive interviews coming up if you are a Patreon subscriber, which you can listen to for just a few dollars, a monthly subscription. You will be able to hear James McLean and myself chatting with... who did we chat with? Philip Martin. Stephen Gallagher.
Oh.
And... this is where you should have like a kind of a drum bit, but I won't. All right, stop. It's hurting my ears. And Graham Harper.
Oh, fantastic.
Graham Harper was quite pleased to talk to James and myself. He seemed to be enjoying himself immensely and declared at the end of the interview, and I don't think I recorded this, unfortunately, that we should have our own show, our own TV show.
I would certainly watch it. I would be your one viewer.
But as I mentioned, the other interviews that we did, you will need to be a Patreon subscriber. Now, there are a few of you. Thank you. And we'll be name-checking you all again next month. I think it's $5, and you can, for a month, monthly subscription, $5. It supports the podcast, it pays for hosting, helps to pay for things like us going to WarpCon, because James McLean and myself both live about 200 miles from Manchester. So my maths ain't great, so it might not be 200 miles, but, you know, it's a two-hour drive there, and then a two-hour drive back, and James has to get a train and stuff like that. So to go into things, your monthly subscription helps immensely. So thank you for those of you who are already supporting us, and please, if you're not already, please give some good consideration. Moving on.
Just before you move on, I've been thinking for the past 5 minutes while you've been talking about WarpCon, about the idea of an Ark of Infinity Omega puppet.
Yeah.
I'm thinking you could just take a Peter Davison puppet and pick bits off it as the course of the day goes on. Do you think it's marketable?
I think nearly right, but I think you would start off by gluing some Rice Krispies to the face.
Yes. Yes, definitely Rice Krispies, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, right.
Other than that, yeah, I agree. Christopher Eccleston has revealed that he is writing his memoir.
Mm.
Which comes hot on the heels of other Doctor Who memoirs, such as, I just got hold of Peter Davison's, actually, a couple of days before I went to WarpCon. I was hoping to speak to him. He's actually in one of the interviews, but he's more of a amused observer, chuckling in the background, than actually taking part in any of the conversations. And if he hadn't have gone, then hopefully we would have probably spoken to him, but he had to catch a train. But, yeah, do you know, I've just, this is nothing to do with the podcast with the K. I just put a curry in the slow cooker, and I was grating some chili, and I've just rubbed my eye. So the rest of this podcast will be conducted with one eye open and the other one streaming. Yes, so Pete Davidson's memoir, I started reading that and I was amused. I was taken by how disarming it opens up. He basically says he's not really got anything to say, in paraphrasing that. But so I'd be interested to see how Eccleston, I imagine Eccleston's will be considerably more earnest.
Yes.
Have you read, James, have you read the Davidson autobiography?
Yeah, I have, and I enjoyed it immensely. What I thought was nice about it was the fact that it's so compartmentalised. He doesn't spend more than a chapter on Doctor Who. And yes. We should be clear on this for the benefit of listeners who are sort of thinking about buying it. I mean, it's a great book, it's a great read, it's very interesting. He's a very interesting career. But considering that he's always going to be known as the Fifth Doctor now, the amount of space it gives towards Doctor Who is less than one might expect, and perhaps even hope for. But having said that, it doesn't feel like an uneven read as a result of that. It feels like he spends the right amount of time on each thing.
Well, Tom Baker doesn't spend a lot of time on Doctor Who either.
Sorry, was that?
In Tom Baker, in Who on Earth is Tom Baker, he doesn't spend an enormous amount of time on Doctor Who either.
I can believe it. Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think it's uncommon. The last, I'm looking forward to this. The last one I finished was, I think, either Mary Tams or Liz Sladen's, I forget. But it was in that, they both came out quite close to each other, so, comparatively speaking. I don't think I've read anything since, apart from dipping into Who on Earth is Tom Baker, for obvious reasons.
The US Sladen's.
Me? Yeah. Yeah. It was good. I mean, something I found going back to the Davidson autobiography is it's a very honest book.
Yeah.
And he's not, it's not quite brutal, but he does tell things warts and all. I mean, he tells things against himself as well. But he doesn't hold back about some of the other people. I mean, I found some of it, I suppose, was, verging on the cruel, actually. But I don't think he meant to be unkind, but there were some honest reflections on other people, as well as on himself. I mean, he's probably harder on himself than he is on other people, but it isn't sanitized. And I found that particularly interesting. The Liz Sladen autobiography is very good, but I thought the Davidson one was better written. So I would recommend it.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Tom Baker autobiography is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, every Doctor Who fan should have Tom Baker's autobiography, regardless of whether they're an old Who fan or a new Who fan. Christopher Eccleston's...
I mean, not only is it very interesting and a cunning insight into sort of the... There's a lot of insight into Baker's sort of upbringing and the things that perhaps happened that shaped the man he became later. But, I mean, besides all that, it's a very... very funny book. I mean,
it's
hilarious in places. It really is.
Laugh out loud. Laugh out loud. People staring at you on the train. Hilarious.
Absolutely.
Yes. I mean, it was very successful with non-Doctor Who people as well. I think that I can't remember who the publisher was now. I think it's Hamish Hamilton. And they were expecting a sort of niche autobiography that would just sell to Doctor Who fans. And when they got it, they thought, God, this is going to sell to everybody, and it was a very popular book. Funnily enough, there were hardly any reviews of it because somebody at the publishers messed up on review copies, and I think about the only review was in the Catholic Journal, the Tablet. What Tom says about the Catholic Church is not desperately complimentary, but they were very, very fulsome in their praise of it, and just said this is very, very funny, and you must read it.
I remember some time ago when there was a website that I edited to do with Doctor
Who. Oh, yes, I remember that.
Yeah, and there was an article about Tom Baker, And there's some relation to his autobiography, but it was years after it came out. It's probably the Where We Kicked Pigs, actually. And it got picked up by a Jewish news website.
Yeah.
And I inquired to them as to why this was the case. And they said, because Tom Baker was Jewish. I said, well he's a Catholic. I said, no, but his father was Jewish, apparently.
My understanding is that Jews trace Jewishness through the mother. From a Jewish point of view, he wouldn't be Jewish.
Yes, exactly.
But there you are.
I mean, and my mother was not Jewish, but her mother was, and therefore I am. The line stops with me in that sense.
Yes, interesting.
Yes. Anyway. Ian McGregor is publishing director of non-fiction at Simon & Schuster. He says, like many, many people across Britain today, Chris bears the pain and loss of a dear parent who was taken by his incredibly vile condition. He wanted to not only record his father's journey, but to celebrate his life and that of his family also. We are privileged to decide to take this journey with Simon & Schuster UK. Because the key to this book is Eccleston's father's dementia.
Yeah.
So it will be, I don't think it will be a pleasant read in places. Hopefully it will be reassuring in others. I Love the Bones of You, which is a heartbreaking and beautiful title, says Philip Bates at the Doctor Who Companion, will be published in September 2019.
Quite a way to them.
12 months away, yes.
Mm.
We'll be talking about it.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. I mean, I think dealing with the elephant in the TARDIS here is that everybody's going to want to know how much detail he will go into when it comes to a certain point in his TV career. I've always sort of hoped that there might be a documentary of some sort where Christopher Eccleston wakes up in Port Merion surrounded by journalists who want to know why he resigned. I think that will probably work because everybody, it is going to be the question, is he finally going to talk about, is he going to name names? Is he going to give the details? And I suspect that he probably won't.
But
I think that's going to be the speculation building up over the next year. It's going to be a long year in that sense.
I think we can probably piece together a lot of what happened anyway from, you know, what the various comments that have been made, and he's been more explicit of late. I mean, it does look as though there was some on-set bullying going on, and it looks as though it wasn't directed at him, but he intervened and there was a confrontation and a falling out.
Mm-hmm. You
know, exactly who the persons involved were, we don't know. We can probably make a good guess.
Yes.
But,
There were other things going on behind the scenes in people's personal lives as well. So even if he did tell what happened on set, it still wouldn't give you the full story of what happened. So
no,
I mean, yeah, it's no great secret that the production of that first revived series was problematic, and that they didn't know what they were doing, and that the slick machine that is now in place was certainly not in place, and that had fallout and consequences. I'm not excusing any behaviour, but I think that, as you say, it was very complicated.
Yes.
And whatever he says in the book, we're not going to get the full story still.
Indeed. So, Doctor Who Series 11 is going to be upon us on October the
7th.
7th, which is a Sunday, people. A Sunday. We've talked about this previously, and in last week's live podcast, in front of a live audience of live people at the live WarpCon, which you can listen to, we talked to it then, and get an interesting reaction from our live audience.
Mm.
we now have some episode titles.
Yes.
We have new images. We know the first episode is the horrendously on the nose, The Woman Who Fell to Earth.
Ooh.
And the second episode is called The Ghost Monument.
Ooh.
Which is a far more interesting title. That's the sort of stuff I want. It guest stars Sean Dooley, Susan Lynch, and Art Malik.
Yeah, they kept that under that swell, didn't they?
Just?
Is he playing a Dalek?
Yeah.
I don't think so. So, so that's interesting news. I'm interested in seeing Art Malik in Doctor Who. Not necessarily as a guest, but there you go. You can't have it everywhere, can you? Fantastic actor. He's done some great stuff, hasn't he, Art Malik? He was the bad guy in True Lies.
Yep.
Yes.
He was in The Living Daylights.
Yes.
Casualty.
Casualty, seriously.
He was in Casualty, yeah.
I think everybody in Spotlight was in Casualty.
One of the two.
Yes.
One of the two. He was in, and of course the Jewel in the Crown, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, back 35 years ago. So, yeah, he's done lots of good stuff, Art Malik. So, yeah, surprised he hasn't been in Doctor Who before now.
Good actor. He was very hot, especially in the 80s.
Hmm. Well, he was in an episode of Doc Martin a couple of years ago. Like, the last is Doc Martin he's in. Last one that they produced. He's, that was, quite recent. And yeah, he's always good. He's a good, solid character actor, and he plays a good villain in True Lies, which is kind of pretty much the last great Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, in my opinion.
Now I'd have to stop you there.
Oh, would you?
No reason, I just have to stop you. I refuse to accept that was the last great Arnie film. There must have been at least one since that was worth watching. Oh, The Expendables 2.
Mm.
I know it's not a full-scale starring Mulder, but The Expendables 2 is great. Yeah, okay. Can we just have that one?
Right, okay. I'll let you go off that.
Yes.
Maybe. Yes. Okay. So, Doctor Who is going to be... I mean, we're talking 3 weeks. Doctor Who is back.
Yeah.
How do we feel about that?
I am tremendously excited, and I can hardly contain myself.
I can tell. James?
It's fine. You know, whatever. I don't know. It just feels like, I mean, there's been a lot of build-up now, and the closer we get, the more I'm thinking, it'll be another series with its ups and downs and disappointments. I think the problem I've got...
That's very prophetic of you.
I need to actively disengage from the fandom a bit.
Yes.
Because I think I've been hanging around with fans too long.
Fandom needs to disengage from the fandom.
And I know what will happen. It will be a glorious triumph, and it will be a dismal failure.
Yeah.
And ne'er the twain shall meet, except on Facebook where they argue. And there will be people claiming it's a disaster and people claiming it's wonderful. There seems to be this tendency for hyperbole these days, which is arguing. And it's not just the Doctor Who, it's not just TV, it's everything. We live in a world of extremes, and the grey areas where I like to live, where things are neither sort of perfect nor disastrous, but usually a sort of a combination of the two with some good stuff and some bad stuff, seems to be somewhat out of favour. Mm. And it seems to be that there is a need for Doctor Who to either be the most wonderful thing in the world or a shadow of its former self and dead in the water. At the moment you say something like, well, you know, it'll probably be pretty good.
Yeah.
People shout at you.
Well, yeah. I think what we need to do is just remember that we are a Doctor Who podcast, so we have a particular piece of skin in this discussion. And, you know...
I've never had that expression.
We have skin in this fight. I'm just adapting a phrase. It's not worked. I'm not going to do it again.
I've never heard that expression either. Okay.
But anyway, the point is, it's not up to us. It's not up to the producers. It's not up to the BBC. Well, I mean, the BBC can influence it slightly, but ultimately, it's up to the people that tune in. Mm. And if they tune in and they love it, it'll be a success. If they tune in and then turn over, it won't be a success. So it is up to the audience whether this is a success. As it is with any series of Doctor Who or any series of anything, as it was anything that is on telly, if the audience takes to it, it'll be a success. If they don't, then it will be quietly forgotten about. I've been continuing my voyage through the David Tennant Doctor Who's recently, and I have to tell you, I had no idea how... I mean, I you know, I enjoyed it. I was critical of it at the time and stuff, but it surprises me how much fun it still is to watch. I mean, obviously Tennant has a lot of energy, but, you know, the stories of Pacey, we just watched the Smith and Jones and then the Shakespeare Code. Smith and Jones is superb. It's just so much fun. And it's a good stepping on point for Doctor Who as well. It doesn't require you to know anything about it. Everything's explained because you get a new companion who then has to learn what's going on. So, yeah, it's good. It's fun. It's that fun. I know I said this last time when I spoke to you guys. There's fun in Doctor Who that's long since departed. Right there. And, you know, if Doctor's going to come back and be a success, it needs to be emulating that era, in my opinion, rather than...
It was, I was watching, they've just put Quatermass and the Pit, the original TV series version, they've just put it up on iPlayer. If anybody hasn't seen it, it's absolutely superb, even though it's now 60 years old, would you believe? But, I rewatched that. I also made the mistake of watching some of it late at night, which is not a good idea. that's an object lesson in this is how to do a very, very gutsy science fiction drama series. Obviously it is very similar to Doctor Who, and you can see that you can see its influence throughout the series, really, especially in classic Who. I just was reflecting on the difference in tone between late Moffat Who from sort of late Matt Smith onwards and something like Quatermass, and how different it is. And I just wonder if, you know, the emphasis these days is on making a product and making a product that's going to net the maximum viewing figures on the widest demographic and so on, and to be a marketable product that they can sell overseas. And that's the prime focus. Whereas I think, you know, I think actually that wasn't the prime focus in Classic Who days, and probably in the early Russell T. Davis days. You know, they were, the prime focus was on making as good a program as they possibly could, and then only secondarily on making something that ticked all the boxes. I just wonder, from all the hype that Chibnall and co. have been putting out about the new series, whether it's actually going to live up to that hype. It's sort of being marketed as zany and funny and crazy, and I just wonder.
I would echo that. Yeah. I think there is... you're absolutely right about... tone and how much it's changed. I mean, lest we forget, Doctor Who was literally brought in 1963 in order to win a ratings battle and stop people turning off their TV at a certain time on a Saturday.
Yes,
and it was created around the audience they were losing and the audience that you would be watching. That's kind of where, and then as time went on, that audience changed fundamentally.
Yes.
And they grew up. Yes. And they now watch, and I think the biggest problem you have is when you are trying too hard to retain that audience.
Yeah.
I don't know if the answer is zaniness or not, though. I don't know if that, as I've said before, I think the issue we have with Doctor Who is the desire to keep it for us and not allow it to become what it needs to become.
Yes.
And I do wonder whether this is something that it needs to become. And if we don't recognise it as a consequence of that, then that needn't necessarily be a disaster. You talked about, last time we interacted, Simon, you talked about the first series and how there wasn't a joke in it.
Yeah.
This is the 1963 series where the Doctor nearly kills a caveman with a rock, and there's the Aztecs and there's the Daleks. And it's all very dark. And that is absolutely unrecognisable from even something like the first Davies series, or even Tom Baker's late era. It was very funny. Doctor Who has changed so much over the years, and people that I speak to these days seem to think that the changes have been warts only recently, and Moffat has changed it.
That's right.
And Chibnall is going to change it. Whereas, in fact, I mean, if you saw somebody, if you had Bill Hartnell and sat him down in front of, I don't know, the Horns of Nyman, what would he have said to that? He probably would have said, "This is not the show that I set out to create," and he would have been right, and it wouldn't have mattered. But I think then Doctor Who evolves, and this is another very concrete step in its evolution, and it remains to be seen whether it's going to be a good thing or not. But it's always about selling the product. It's just changes.
I think I made the point, it might have been last time, that Doctor Who fans, perhaps to some of the more, you know, sort of faithful viewing public as well, they do have their own particular favourite era or style of Doctor Who, and then measure every other part of Doctor Who according to how well it measures up to that standard. And, you know, if you read... I don't want to get into controversy here, but if you read the Time Team's comments on Classic Who and Doctor Who magazine, you know, their starting point is that New Who is standard Who, and then they're watching old-fashioned Doctor Who and not getting it because of the differences. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It isn't the fans' property, and clearly it has to. If it is going to survive, it has to evolve. One of the criticisms that's often made of some of Colin Baker's stuff is that it tries too hard to be like it used to be and failed as a result because it wasn't being innovative. It was trying to hark back too much.
Yeah, and a part of the problem with that was casting. And Colin Baker, as talented as he is as a performer, was not able. I mean, if you watch those episodes, certainly the early ones, he is clearly trying to be a Hartnell. Hartnell was his worth, and he wasn't old enough to carry that off. You need somebody who could be the crotchety grandfather figure. That's the only way to carry off that character effectively. And at the time, he wasn't old enough to be able to do that. And he did the best he could with the scripts he had, but he wasn't able to actually fulfil that. Essentially, it was bad writing in that sense. I mean, to clarify, you talk about Time Team, and we won't go into that too much here. But I would say that I think there's nothing wrong with recognising that Doctor Who has changed and Doctor Who needs to change. I also think if you're in a place where you are judging older episodes and stories by your own contemporary standards, you are going to run into hot water.
Yeah.
And I think it's needless. Unpack this any more than we absolutely have to, but that is a pattern I see. People say, "Oh, I don't like it was 40 years ago, and therefore it is different to the way I think." And you think, "Well, you know, yes, it was 40 years ago. That's kind of the way that TV works and the way that society works. And are you really judging it for being so different?"
Well, I mean, I would largely agree with what you say there, but there has been an interview with Chibnall. I'm not sure. I don't think it's the SFX interview. In which he says that he's aiming to educate people. Now, that wasn't... Both times that's been attempted on Doctor Who, it didn't last very long.
Mm.
And I would suggest that possibly, maybe, if people feel like they have been preached to, they're not going to be enjoying it.
No. I also think that, funnily enough, my leg's playing up. Funnily enough, there was a documentary on Radio 4 yesterday about identity politics in the fine arts, which I was listening to as I was driving up the M11. It was jolly interesting. That was about the way that a lot of contemporary art students and very young artists, you know, people who are still at college and so on, produce art which is simply a sort of medium for a political message. And the argument of the guy who was presenting it was that because it's preaching, it is therefore unsuccessful as art, because it can only be interpreted in one way and because it bashes people over the head with something. And therefore it doesn't work. I mean, I don't think that we're going to get that with Doctor Who. There may be a bit sneaked in here or there. And I think you know, you could argue that Barry Letts' time was terribly green and we were being bashed over the head by the Ecology Party, as it then was, or...
I think it was a bit subtler, though, wasn't it? I mean, obviously, we can't say what Doctor Who's doing now, but, you know, looking at what it's done in the last couple of years, I think that, you know, that era was a lot more subtle.
Yes. Yes, that's right. But, I mean, I think one of the other things about preachiness is, as you say, it does alienate people. And a lot of the time, you know, if it's saying, hey, look, we live in a multi-ethnic society, we've got to reflect that. Well, who's going to disagree with that, you know?
We can't. I mean, it's reality, isn't it? You can't disagree with reality.
Sometimes you're saying that sometimes the message that is being conveyed is something that people agree with anyway, you know, so you rather wonder what's the point.
Yeah, and then you've got the other... I mean, you only have to look at what's happened politically on both sides of the Atlantic in the past 3 or 4 years with celebrities who've come out on one side or the other. Yeah. And, you know, they lose thousands, if not millions, of Twitter fans, followers, whatever, for expressing an opinion.
Yes.
I think it's a dangerous path to take, to be honest with you. Do people want to be preached to, or do they just want an hour of escapism? You know, people want to be preached to, then there's somewhere they can go on a Sunday morning or a Saturday evening or, you know, whatever day of the week.
Yeah.
Float your particular sky god.
I mean, you talk about being subtle. I was in the others. I was just recalling The Green Death, which is one of my absolute favourite stories. Mm-hmm. It has arguably the best companion departure of the lot.
Yeah.
Arguably. Let's not go into that. It has certainly one of the best supercomputer that they ever had.
Yes.
It has Pertwee dressed up as a milkman and a cleaner, I think possibly with the same episode. Or certainly within sort of, but my God, is it preachy? If you think they turn on the environmental angle thick, and I wonder
the preachometer,
and I wonder at the time, and I genuinely don't know how it would have been received, and how whether people would have thought, actually, you know what, this is a bit much. You compare that to the Hangover.
I did see it on its first broadcast. And although I was about 8 or something, so I probably didn't appreciate the whole message and so forth. I think it is also counterbalanced, because although it is green and so on, you also get in The Green Death the sort of minus reaction, because they're being laid off because there's this move from coal to oil, and they're going to get wonderful new jobs with global chemicals. And then here come a lot of middle-class do-gooders saying, oh, no, boy, you can't do that. That's very, very bad indeed. And they say, well, why don't you bugger off?
I thought they were Welsh.
Oh, well, exactly. But they say, why don't you get lost? Because you're a bunch of middle-class do-gooders. And, you know, that is the other point of view of the whole wheel community, you know. So it's a little... Maybe it is a bit more nuanced than... I don't know. Maybe it's a bit more nuanced than we give it credit for. I mean, I think the thing is that the message doesn't dictate the drama. The message is quite subtly done, rather than, you know, here is my worldview and I'm going to smash you over the head with it, and you're some kind of degenerate if you don't agree with everything I say.
One of my favourite scenes in New Who is Series 4 in Planet of the Ood.
Yeah.
The Doctor is talking to Donna, and saying, well, you know, slaves. He said, that's terrible. He said, well, it's not so much different from your time. Who do you think made your clothes? And she looks at him and says, is that why you travel with people, to make cheap shots?
Yeah.
And he is momentarily stunned and says, no, sorry. We'll just stop. And that is a lovely little bit of fourth wall breaking, as if to say, yes, okay, fine, there is a message here, but we're not going to be heavy-handed about it. And Planet of the Ood is not as heavy-handed as it might have been, partly because of that. Even though, you know, there are obvious parallels there with using livestock as commodities rather than sort of as sentient forms in their own right. Planet of the Ood says an awful lot about animal labour.
Yes.
In that sense. But yeah, I mean, you compare something like the Happiness Patrol, which is an absolutely beautiful allegory, and for all its flaws is a wonderful piece of work. I had to explain that recently to somebody who was watching McCoy for the first time and couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
Partly because she didn't have a clue. She didn't have. She was Australian and young and didn't have a clue about what it was saying. And now, so I explained about well, it's an obvious. It's a metaphor. There, this is what was going on in the country at the time. There are. There's a veiled swipe at this person. And yes, the Candyman is ridiculous. But the question is, though, do we like the Happiness Patrol because of that? Or in spite of that, or is it a complete irrelevance? I mean, do we just like the Happiness Patrol because it's fun and because it's got a giant Bertie Bassett? I genuinely don't know the answers to that, and I would be interested to see what you think.
I wouldn't have said that. I confess I don't like the Happiness Patrol, but
get out.
Thank you. I would have said that I just don't think it works. I don't think it's got particularly much to do with the message.
Yeah.
I just don't think it's good. But I don't. The reason I would say I don't think it's good is not because it's trying to convey a message. But as I say, I think that the new series is unlikely to be very heavy-handed with. I don't think it's going to be terribly message-heavy.
No, and if there's one thing that drives me mad, it's the people who say, "Oh yes, well we need to have this in Doctor Who, and we need to have this sort of character in Doctor Who."
Mm.
No, you need the characters. That fit the stories.
Yes, quite.
They did a brilliant piece of work in the last series with that, in that you had in the Pyramid at the End of the World, which is not a good story, but
yes, it is. Contradicting you again.
Fair enough. Well, okay. Whatever you think about Pyramid at the End of the World, one of its strengths was the fact that they had a character of. A woman of diminutive stature.
Oh yeah.
Playing a scientist, who was competent, and the height was never mentioned.
Yes.
Not once. It was just she was just in it and she did stuff and that was it. There were no jokes. There was no patronising back patting. Mm. She just came in. She did her thing and she got on with it. And I liked her because of that.
Yeah.
Because it was like it reminds me of Penny Pocket in Balamori. Do you watch Balamori, Christian?
Yes.
Yeah, Balamori, you have a character in a wheelchair, and not once do they ever mention the fact that she's in a wheelchair.
No, which is surprising, because I don't feel safe with her around, to be honest with you. I think she's an accident waiting to happen, the way she scooched down that shot.
She never knocks anything over, though, does she? Never.
She doesn't, no, but I think that's probably because it's glued down. Everything's screwed down, I think.
There was a character in Tracy Beaker, which my daughter used to be glued to, who had cerebral palsy. And again, that was never mentioned, you know. And it was a very good performance that the chap gave.
Yes, I think I know.
So, I mean, it is possible to be inclusive without being heavy-handed and to be inclusive with this.
Well, if you meet someone in a wheelchair, it's very unlikely you're going to get into a conversation with them about why they're in a wheelchair. Yeah. Unless they raise it, and secondly, even if they have raised it, then that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, the rest of your lives together, your interactions together, aren't going to be about the chair, are they?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's one of the reasons I like. It's one of my objections I have to Under the Lake and Before the Flood from Series 9. The fact that you have a character in there who is deaf, and it is not enough for her to be there and be deaf and in charge. She also has to have a superpower. Her deafness literally becomes a plot point when she turns out to be the only person who can understand what the ghosts are saying because she can live through it, which I felt was just completely unnecessary. And they tried to sort of balance that by having a wonderful scene in the second half when she's walking through a corridor and the ghost is coming up behind her and she can't actually hear it. She can't hear the chain dragging on. She's only able to become aware of its presence at the last minute when she becomes aware of the vibrations of the thing dragging along the floor, the axe or whatever, mallet or whatever it was carrying.
Yeah.
But and I like that, but it just annoys me that you couldn't have that character in there who would just be in there and get on with things and be a part of the team without having to make the deafness a problem solving exercise, which is what it became. But that's just me, and I know that my experience tells me I'm in a minority on that front.
Let's move on, I noticed from the Doctor Who companion that there is, and it's not Doctor Who, it's Blake 7. There's a Blake 7 anthology being released this month. Blake's Legacy, 40 Years of Rebellion, which is edited by Jackie Emery, Susan Bowden and Annie Worrell, with forewords from Michael Keating, Jan Chappell and Stephen Grief.
Mm.
Excellent.
So that looks good.
Can I confess to a certain amount, and you're going to hate me for this, but I have never watched Blake 7.
Ever?
No. And I know everybody. I know I should. Everybody tells me I should. I'm sort of thinking that perhaps when Eldest Child and I have finished The Prisoner, I've obviously seen that before. He is about we're about three episodes from the end. I'm wondering if perhaps we could watch it together afterwards. Is it something to watch with children, or is it something?
Well, the first episode probably isn't. It might give you something tricky to explain. So I think it's aimed more at sort of 14 upwards.
Well, he is 13 and a half.
So. Oh, right. So, yeah, you may be okay then.
Episode episode 2 has Brian Blessed handing out extra strong mints.
Seriously?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, we love a bit of Brian now, Blake, so maybe we'll give it a spin.
It's the thing about Blake 7, series 1 in particular, is that it starts off really strongly,
yeah,
and then it kind of meanders for a little bit, and there's a few weak episodes in there which kind of... they can prove a little bit tricky to get through before you start getting back to the meat. So a certain amount of endurance is required,
I mean, it's very uneven. Very uneven. James, I'd be very interested to hear what your son makes of Fallout.
Oh, I can't wait for us to get to Fallout.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I mean, Emily and I watched it for the first time a few years ago. And I knew some of how it ended, because I've read various things on the internet before we actually got around to watching it, but I told her nothing.
Yeah.
We got to the end credits rolled, and I mean, if you haven't seen Fallout, which is the last episode of The Prisoner, I will not spoil it for you here, but go and watch the Fallout. You should go and watch The Prisoner in its entirety.
Oh, yes.
But the Fallout is flabbergasting in how utterly bonkers and thoroughly confusing it is. It is an episode that raises far more questions than it actually answers. And suffice to say, come the end of it, you are none the wiser. There are a myriad theories about what happens and what's been going on, and you know, the secrets of the village finally stripped back and then making no sense at all when they're revealed. But I like it when TV does that. I mean, yes. Twin Peaks did that last year. Twin Peaks, you got to the end and you think, huh? Now what? And then it stops. Probably for good this time, and I thought it was brilliant because of that.
We were talking about Chris Chibnall earlier, the Chibster, as I call him, for no apparent reason other than it seems easier than saying Chris Chibnall, or even though it's the same number of syllables. He's interviewed in SFX, the current issue of SFX, whilst at the San Diego Comic Con earlier.
Mm.
This year, you've read it, haven't you, James?
I confess, I haven't read the whole thing. I've only read the extracts that have made national press.
Okay, and at least concerning writing, right? Yeah. Okay, and this is concerning writing for the Doctor, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. It's interesting in that Chibnall has basically given some insight into the writing process for Series 11, in that at least some of the writers who penned episodes, possibly even all of them, I'm not sure, will get the source text up for the listening notes so that you can have a look at it for yourselves, dear listener. No singular. But they were writing for a male doctor.
Mm.
And there are a number of reasons as to why this may be the case. I mean, we won't go into that. But we thought it was interesting in that you've got an awful lot of emphasis has been placed, both by advocates and detractors, on the Doctor's gender.
And the BBC.
And the BBC, yes. And the fact that Whittaker has then, or somebody has also said, oh, the gender is not a big deal, we don't talk about it in the new series. And then there's this revelation that the writers were writing for a Doctor they assumed would be male anyway. Or were working towards their conceptualization of what the Doctor would be. And I think the question is how well it's going to work as a result of that, and how different it might sound coming from the voice of a woman. And perhaps it won't sound different at all. But I'm curious as to what your thoughts are on that.
If we're talking, I know, because there's so much going on with this, it is difficult. If you're going to pare it down to the fact that the Doctor is an alien who has this newly discovered ability to change how they appear in a gender-based way, then it makes sense that there should be one way to write the character. And it seems that there has been just one way to write the character. You know, we've seen people like Colin Bacon, Sylvester McCoy, Paul McGann reading lines from other doctors, which suggests that there is largely a single way to write the Doctor. So it makes sense.
Can I just add a footnote there? I was just in casual conversation with, because I'm that in with the greats. But I bumped into Bob Baker at Hooverville Cop, and he said actually you did write, you wrote Tom Baker differently from the way you wrote John Pertwee. Partly because Pertwee, some of the more complex stuff that was given to Tom Baker to say, Pertwee wouldn't have been able to do, or wouldn't have been able to do so effectively. And Mike Tucker, I was talking to about one of the Doctor Who novels that he wrote, and I can't remember what it's called, but it's Clara turns into a beetle in it at one point. And it's a Capaldi adventure, but when he wrote it, Capaldi had not been cast.
Yeah.
He'd been cast, but nobody had seen anything that had been done for Capaldi. And he was given the advice, write it for Pertwee's Doctor, and the readers will fill in the gaps. And in fact, when I read it, I didn't know that. So I didn't have any problem in imagining Capaldi saying these lines that Mike Tucker had given to him. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the Doctor, to some extent, is written generically, but I don't expect it's totally generic. I mean, I don't think J.D. Whittaker is going to say, my boy, very much.
Or probably she also won't go, ah, either, too much.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, there is, you're right, and you do write Pertwee differently to the way you write Baker. But that also is in terms of gender relations. It's, Chibnall has said here, and I quote, it's very hard for me to think of a decision that the Doctor has taken in 55 years that is a gender-based decision or actor or action. He argued, I'd really struggle to think of one. And that, I don't think we've got time to unpack that properly. But it's interesting in that you'd have somebody like Baker in City of Death,
yeah,
talking to the Countess and saying, you're a very beautiful woman, probably, which is a lovely piece of dialogue and quintessentially Douglas Adams. But not something that you would hear Pertwee saying, ever.
Yes.
It feels like a very Bakerish thing to say. Baker never seemed to sort of, everyone was alien to him, men and women.
Right. Is there possibly a kind of a preface to this that it was very much the Tom Baker show at that era,
really
at that point? So there is a kind of, there is an element of sort of self-parody to the show.
And I guess that once the actor's become established in the part, you write for that actor.
Mm.
You've got that actor and the performance in your head. And I think perhaps the, you know, you write for a generic Doctor applies particularly to the early stories for the Doctor when you don't know the way that the actor's going to play it. There's a bit in Doctor Who and the Silurians, for example, where Pertwee's at Dr. Quinn's house, and is look at saying, you know, oh, can I fiddle with your central heating? I'm rather good at that sort of thing. And, oh, yes, what about this cottage? And you can imagine Troughton doing that. Absolutely. It's a very, very Troughton scene. But obviously, because Pertwee's doing it, Pertwee plays it differently. But you can hear the way it's written. It's written for Troughton's Doctor. You know, you could imagine him bumbling around Dr. Quinn's house and getting under Quinn's feet. And Pertwee does it in a more lordly and patrician manner. But anyway, yeah, I mean, we've seen 90 seconds of the leak of of course, we broke the law and watched it. We'd have seen 90 seconds of the leak of Jodie Whittaker. And I actually thought that she's rather like David Tennant. You know, that was the first thing that struck me. And the second thing is, yeah, well, it seems to work.
Yeah.
But again, we have to reserve judgment because we haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
I don't have very high expectations of the new series, but I could be proved wrong. I didn't have, as I've said before, I didn't have high expectations of the last series, and it turned out, in my mind, to be one of the best of the last few years. You know, so I was proved wrong. We'll see.
We will see. We will all see.
One more thing on this is that Chibnall has said that the only time that gender politics could come into play in Series 11 is if the Doctor and her completely platonic companions travel to real-life historical periods.
Yeah.
As a footnote, I would add all Peladon. But,
yes. Yeah. There's nothing only about being a girl, Your Majesty.
But yes, it remains to be seen as to how that will play out and whether it will be a thing or not.
It's just, when we talk about Peladon, it's put me in mind of Badger, 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 the Doctor Who edition, James.
Yes. Marvellous.
Yes. Yeah, that was just a fun little thing I did. I watched Monster Paladin last year and thought, gosh, Invasion of the Badger People really, really is. So yeah, and of course the reason this has come up is because the Badger song, which I suppose most of us here probably remember well when it came out, is 15 years old this September.
It did.
Amazing.
Yes, and is now it's older than YouTube. Of course, when it came out, it was a flash animation.
Yeah.
We forget how difficult video hosting and streaming was in the days before YouTube. It was, I mean, you used to have to compress MPEGs or Winners Media files down to 2 meg sizes so you could email them across a dial-up connection. It was really not easy to do. Then now, of course, YouTube has made everything much, much easier. But yeah, no, that song is now 15 years old, and yeah, I still love it. Absolutely mad. But yeah, no, I took footage of that, and I also matched it with footage from Kinder for the snake bits.
Yes.
So there will be a link to that in the show notes for your entertainment, dear listener.
Entertainment might be pushing it a bit, Chris, you know, but I appreciate
it. For your bemusement. That brings us to the end of this week's podcast with the Cape. Big thanks to James Baldock and Simon Daines. We will be back next week. Some of us will be, anyway, in some configuration or other. Until then, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.